So we are working through the book of Revelation. This is number 25. Been doing this for quite a while. We are about halfway through, though. Let's see. Where to begin on this one? Oh, actually, I don't have the nice little graphic on mine, the electronic version. But, let's begin with the literary structure. I'm going to have to borrow one. So, you know, the book of Revelation can be structured and outlined in any number of ways, and these are... The first one includes the whole thing. It's one that you've seen before. It was right at the very beginning, session one, I think. And what we're in the middle of now is the first one here from Seven Keys by John Pauline. His outline, this is the final crisis. It's the center of this chiastic structure, so it's kind of the, you know, it contains important... It's the center, the important part of Revelation. The diagram, on the left, not left, the right side, is from the commentary reading the New Testament series. And this just describes basically the last half, most of the last half of the book of Revelation. And in it, this commentary notes that this last half, most of it can be also described in a chiastic structure, where chapter 12 begins with this structure, description of the dragon, followed by a description of the beast and the false prophet, and the main part of the structure is the description and the judgment of Babylon in chapters 17 and 18 of Revelation. Now, something to note is that in the first diagram, the left side diagram, in the seven keys, Pauline moves the last verse of chapter 11, verse 19, into the overall section of the final crisis. And so, for him, the content that was, you know, the Ark and the Covenant that was revealed holds significance over the fact that the inner sanctum, the most holy, the Holy of Holies of the temple was opened. And we discussed that last week, where, you know, how, where one places the priority on whether it's the object or the event, you know, the significance of that last verse changes. When you look at the right side, the reading the New Testament series outline of the last part of Revelation, again, the judgment of Babylon is the climax. But what's interesting is that in that chiastic structure, chapters 14 to 16 are missing. For this, the author of the commentary, these chapters apparently did not fit directly into the chiastic structure. However, in the text of the commentary, it reads, "The series of brief visions in the middle might well be the heart of John's message to his readers." And, you know, this roughly corresponds with Pauline's structuring of the book of Revelation. So this center chapters provide the key to the book of Revelation. In the Reading the New Testament series, then the Revelations chapters 12 through 16 serve as an introduction to the John's third in the spirit experience that's described in chapters 17 to 20. There's been two in the spirit experiences that John had already. And the third one is going to come. And this intervening chapters serve as an introduction to that experience. So that's kind of the literary structure, a little review of where we are. So I'm going to read the entire chapter 12. And a great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. She was pregnant and was crying out in birth pains in the agony of giving birth. And another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his head 7 diadems. His tail swept down a third of the stars of heaven and cast them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman who was about to give birth, so that when she bore her child, he might devour it. She gave birth to a male child, one who is to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. But her child was caught up to God and to his throne. And the woman fled into the wilderness, where she has a place prepared by God in which she is to be nourished for 1,260 days. Now war arose in heaven, Michael and his angels fighting against the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought back, but he was defeated, and there was no longer any place for them in heaven. And the great dragon was thrown down, that ancient serpent, who is called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. He was thrown down to the earth, and his angels were thrown down with him. And I heard a loud voice in heaven saying, Now the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ have come, for the accuser of our brothers has been thrown down, who accuses them day and night before our God. And they have conquered him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, for they loved not their lives even unto death. Therefore, rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them. But woe to you, O earth and sea, for the devil has come down to you in great wrath, because he knows that his time is short. And when the dragon saw that he had been thrown down to the earth, he pursued the woman who had given birth to the male child. But the woman was given the two wings of the great eagle, so that she might fly from the serpent into the wilderness, to the place where she is to be nourished for a time and times and half a time. The serpent poured water like a river out of his mouth after the woman to sweep her away with a flood. But the earth came to the help of the woman, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed the river that the dragon had poured from his mouth. Then the dragon became furious with the woman and went off to make war on the rest of her offspring, on those who keep the commandments of God and hold the testimony of Jesus. And he stood on the sand of the sea. So, sounds familiar, okay.
What a lot of people think of as this is what Revelation is. The heart of Revelation.
Okay. So this is what Revelation is all about. It's a familiar passage, and depending on what your denominational background happens to be, there's different ways that it's been interpreted. You know, the ones that I think most of us are familiar with is kind of this allegorical interpretation, that it's describing the birth of Christ, Satan's fall, a third of the angels follow Satan, Christ's return to heaven. The woman represents the church who goes into hiding for 1,260 years. There's a recap of a war that occurred in heaven where Satan and his angels were cast out. Satan persecutes the church. The church is afforded protection. Satan cannot harm the woman, so in anger, he goes after her offspring. And the church's offspring are those who keep the commandments of God and hold the testimony of Jesus. And, it seems to fit. But verses 10 and 11 seem a little out of place. Now, after Satan is cast down, after he was thrown down from down to the earth from heaven, and his angels were thrown down with him, verses 10 and 11 read, "And I heard a loud voice in heaven saying, Now the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ have come, for the accuser of our brothers has been thrown down, who accuses them day and night before our God. And they have conquered him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, for they loved not their lives even unto death." The casting down, the throwing down of Satan from heaven is associated with the salvation and power for the saints. It seems a little odd. If that throwing down was directly related to the original, you know, so-called war in heaven where Satan was cast down, why in the world would that bring salvation for the power to the saints? Secondly, the saints are said to have already conquered Satan because of this event. And also, what in the world does the rest of verses 12 through the end of the chapter have to do with the with woe and wrath for the earth? Do any of the earlier portions of Revelation that we've already looked at have anything to do with this passage and what is going to follow in this book? Now, if this is a dramatic narrative, as we've been kind of assuming, what we see here, we can't see this as a completely new thing that's happening. It needs to be connected to what has already been seen. And so, what images are we going to see and receive when we explore this passage in light of Old Testament allusions and parallel imagery that has already appeared so far in this book? Chapter 12, there's at least four different ways that people have structured it. As three different events. That's the one that we just the allegorical interpretation. Verses 1 through 6 describe Jesus' incarnation, crucifixion, and ascension. Verses 7 through 12 describe some kind of a prehistoric war that occurred in heaven. And verses 13 through 17 describe the church age, what has happened since, after Jesus' ascension, and through time that follows, what has happened to the church. Second way of looking at it is two views of the same event. Verses 1 through 6 and 7 through 17 are two ways of looking at the same event from different perspectives. And they both describe Jesus' incarnation, obedience, sacrifice, and exaltation that gained victory over Satan. A third way of looking at this chapter is to see it as two different events. Verses 1 through 6 describe Jesus' incarnation and ascension, and verses 7 through 17 describe events at the beginning of the Great Tribulation, which is related to the 3.5 years, part of the final week of the 70 weeks of Daniel chapter 9, verse 27. This is the interpretation that many of the evangelical churches take, where when it says that the last week of the 70 weeks then Daniel was cut off, they place that at the very end of time. And the 70th week itself is divided into half of 3.5 years each. And so this is where this view comes from. The fourth way of looking at chapter 12 is to see it as four parts. Verses 1 through 6 describe a confrontation between the dragon and the woman. Verses 7 through 9 describe a war in heaven between Michael and the dragon. Verses 10 through 12 is a commentary by a great voice that comes from heaven. And verses 13 to 18 is a continuation of the confrontation between the dragon and the woman and her offspring. So this last way of structuring chapter 12 is more of a narrative that's not bound to any time. So where do all these strange images come from? The woman, the dragon, the slaying, the war, all of these things. Well, there's a lot of background. And this is, this is all from the InterVarsity Press Bible Background Commentary on the New Testament. I'll begin by reading here. This vision reapplies imagery that was widely known in ancient mythology. A pervasive Greek story spread in several forms presented Leto begetting the god Apollo while opposed by the dragon Python. Apollo then pursued the dragon Python and slew him. So that's a Greek story. In an Egyptian story, the goddess Isis gave birth to the sun god Horus as the red dragon Typhon was pursuing her. Horus eventually killed Typhon. Such popular stories seem also to have been applied to the Roman emperor, whose rule is here linked with the evil dragon, in contrast with Roman tradition, which portrayed him in terms of the hero Apollo. Although these stories omit many details, John includes from other sources, and it should be noted that his whole account could be reproduced from the Old Testament and Jewish sources, they indicate that all his readers could identify with a storyline modern readers often find impenetrable. But ancient readers familiar with the Bible would especially recognize here the story of Israel giving birth to Jesus and Satan's opposition to God's people. John is taking stories, mythologies, imagery from Greeks, Romans, Egyptians, and his own background, Jewish background, and portraying something that is happening, a birth of a god. Continuing, the sun, moon, and 12 stars help identify the woman as 12 tribes of Israel. Judaism in this period often associated 12 signs of the zodiac with the 12 tribes, despite biblical prohibitions against astrological speculation. Indeed, the romance novel Joseph and Asenath borrows 12 rays from typical Greek imagery for the sun god. So in the dream that Joseph had, and one of the dreams that Joseph had, had the sun, the moon, and the stars bowing. It's where the identification of these astronomical objects as Israel comes from. The Old Testament portrayed faithful Israel, or Judah, or Jerusalem, as a virgin or God's bride, but their unfaithful equivalent as a prostitute. Thus the tale of two cities that contrast the heavenly Jerusalem and Babylon the prostitute. So this idea of a woman representing a group of people comes from the Old Testament.
So was Joseph and Asenath a romance novel in their time?
Yes. Righteous Israel was portrayed as the mother of the restored future remnant of Israel. an image freely mixed with the image of Israel as a bride. And see the references there. So as Israel and Judah, they were continually falling and failing to meet God's expectations. The prophets had prophesied that righteous Israel would become a mother of the restored future remnant of Israel. So this prophecy also included this idea of a woman as a future group of righteous people. Ancient Mesopotamian myths portrayed seven-headed monsters. Later Jewish tradition linked the worship of dragons to Babylon. The image of a seven-headed serpent or dragon was also part of Canaanite mythology that the Israelites symbolically turned to better purposes. God's parting the Red Sea was now symbolized as a defeat of the primeval serpent Leviathan or Lotan. The Greek hero Heracles also confronted a seven-headed dragon, the Lernaean Hydra in Greek mythology, although the number of heads changed quickly. Serpents were also associated with Asclepius. Their association with Athena is less relevant in Asia Minor. Serpent veneration is common in many cultures and prevailed in a Gnostic sect called the Ophites in the 2nd century. So, you know, the dragon, the serpent, sometimes multi-headed, symbolized something that was evil, common across multiple cultures. Although in the case of Asclepius, the serpent, now it's the symbol of healing. If you, the medical profession uses that symbol. So one can say that in ancient mythology, the serpent has an ambiguous status. So it can be either evil or good. And you see that being used in Moses, the story of the fiery serpents attacking Israel in the wilderness, and where Moses is commanded to create a bronze image of a serpent. So it's one of the more interesting and odd stories.
And when you look at the bronze image, you will be healed.
Yeah.
That's also very strange.
But
from our point of view.
Yeah, for the ancients, including Israel, the serpent has an ambiguous. Mm-hmm. It's ambiguous. Continuing here. Jewish traditions usually assign the fall of angels to the period of Adam, or more often to Noah's time. But Revelation links their fall especially with rebellion against Christ. Virgil and other Roman writers also extolled the birth of a divine boy who would bring deliverance to the world. The first emperor, Augustus, quickly filled the role of the divine savior in imperial ideology. In Revelation, however, the emperor is a puppet of the dragon, whereas Jesus is the divine leader of a group persecuted for rejecting the imperial cult. In the various forms of the Greco-Roman and Near Eastern myth, the divine child was sheltered until he returned to slay the dragon. Here he is kept at God's throne until he comes to destroy the dragon. In the light of Psalm 2, Isaiah 9, and Micah 5, the birth probably indicates Jesus' death, resurrection, and messianic enthronement, not his literal birth. And the last bit here. As elsewhere in the New Testament, the interim between Jesus' first coming and second coming is compared with Israel between Egypt and the Promised Land. The Jewish people were also expecting a new exodus of final deliverance in the wilderness. More than 1,260 days had obviously already passed since Jesus' exaltation. but symbolic numbers were standard fare for apocalyptic texts. Although 1,260 days refers to the Great Tribulation of Daniel, Revelation apparently reapplies it as a general symbol for final tribulation of the whole course of the present age. Daniel's own numbers were a reapplication of Jeremiah, and some other apocalyptic writers also described other periods of tribulation symbolically as 1,260 days, to characterize the kind rather than the length of the time they described. The language of older prophets was commonly reused in Old Testament, later Jewish and Greek prophecies. Sometimes prophecies and other texts sought to evoke the same meaning as the earlier texts, and at other times they simply borrowed earlier languages' standard prophetic imagery without implying that they referred to the same meaning. I think the point of that is to say that perhaps, you know, in trying to interpret some of these details, we shouldn't go overboard in trying to identify precisely what they mean.
Precise dates and the interval between them.
Okay, so that with that now we can go into. We're going to examine the first six verses today, primarily. We'll leave the rest of chapter 12 for next time. But pretty much, you know, all of the commentaries that structure this chapter, structure the first six verses as a single unit. And they seem to pretty much come to some sort of agreement on what it means. Maybe not in precise detail, but they come to agreement on the general idea of what it means. So the first thing is that a woman appears. It's the first of three signs in heaven that John is going to describe in the next several chapters. This woman is described, as we have learned, in terms of Old Testament Israel. This is a woman who is given astronomical descriptions. You know, the idea of 12 stars. She is pregnant. She's giving birth. There's an exodus into the wilderness, and she is cared for by God. Now, this is all language and imagery that Old Testament writers used in various places to describe the nation of Israel. Some of these descriptions can also be seen in the attributes that were used to describe Jesus earlier in Revelation. Well, for example, the astronomical descriptions of things like the sun and the stars. When Jesus was being described, he was described as having, you know, shining like the sun or holding stars. So we can see that there may be some kind of a relationship between that. That this woman has a relationship, some kind of a relationship with Jesus. The woman can be allegorically associated with the church. But the problem is that to identify the woman specifically as the church is that the church cannot give birth to the Messiah. Okay, the Messiah precedes the church. So the old Israel, the nation of Israel, can give birth to the Messiah, but then, you know, does the woman suddenly turn into the church after giving birth? Well, that's kind of maybe a little bit of a stretch there. So perhaps the best identification of this woman is, you know, the group that represents God's servants throughout history. You know, throughout history, God's chosen people. The Messiah just happens to appear from this group at a particular point in time. Which I think is important in, you know, kind of this John's thesis that Israel has always been a group of God's chosen people. And there's a continuation from old Israel to the church. That they, it doesn't magically change. And we see that John continues to borrow this Exodus imagery. We've been seeing this idea of the Exodus continuing the last few chapters, and John continues to use that imagery. This woman is Israel. She gives birth, and she faces an Exodus as part of her deliverance. Yeah. Next, we see a great red dragon. This is the second of three signs in heaven. The third sign doesn't appear until, I believe it's chapter 15. This great red dragon is associated with Leviathan, a sea monster, and serpents. Serpents would be land dwellers. Seven heads and seven diadems. Number seven represents some kind of a completeness or a totality. And so, seven heads with seven diadems may be a representation of completeness of authority. So this dragon has complete authority over its sphere, whatever its sphere happens to be. It has 10 horns. The 10 horns are an allusion to Daniel chapter 7. And mathematically and such, the 7 heads and 10 horns don't work out. It's another indication that we're not to take some of these things literally. You know, it's symbolic, pointing to images and concepts that John is borrowing from the Old Testament and from surrounding cultures and mythology. Horns themselves represent power. That's been established. The Old Testament refers to horns frequently as symbols of power. This allusion to Daniel chapter 7 brings in a picture of terrifying power that is opposed to God and to his people. This dragon sweeps a third of the stars from heaven. Where have we seen the phrase "a third" before in Revelation?
In references to destruction of a third.
Right. John has previously used the phrase "a third" in conjunction with judgment. Mm-hmm. And a third has always been used as a way of constraining the judgment. No, it's not total judgment. A third is used in conjunction with the restraint of power. Complete destruction was not permitted. The sweeping down a third of stars is also an allusion to Daniel chapter 8, verse 10, where a little horn casts down some of the host and stars of heaven and tramples upon them. And going further down in Daniel chapter 8, an angel comes to give Daniel an interpretation of this. And these stars refer not to heavenly beings, but to God's people. So, an allegorical interpretation of this event referring to evil angels being cast down is possible, but is not necessary, nor is it likely. Now, a star can refer to literal angels, but also they can be symbolic as heads of tribes, the 12 stars in Joseph's vision, or of churches, the 7 stars that Jesus is holding, the heads of the 7 churches. In Revelation chapter 1, John is given the interpretation that the 7 stars represent the angels of the 7 churches. And when we were discussing what that meant, we said that, you know, we're not exactly sure what that means. That they could represent literal heavenly beings that are watching over the each of the churches, or they can mean that the messengers that were sent to each of these churches, or they could mean even mean the person who read the book of Revelation at each of these churches. So again, the emphasis here is that star can refer to angels, but it can also refer to people. The final thing to note is that the causative agent who causes the sweeping down and who causes the throwing down are different. And so the two verses may be speaking to separate events. In verse 4, it said that the dragon swept down. And in verse 9, someone other than the dragon throws the dragon and the angels down from heaven. So those two events are not necessarily the same. So we may not come to an absolute conclusive identification of what this sweeping down of a third means, but we do know the identity of the dragon. In verse 9, John writes very clearly that this dragon is the devil and Satan. Just a a little interesting side note is that there's no direct link between Satan and the serpent in the Old Testament. No, the serpent is never identified as Satan. In fact, the word Satan it means basically adversary, one who is against. The direct link is found in some of the other extra-biblical writings, such as the Apocalypse of Moses and Life of Adam and Eve. The function of this dragon is to deceive the whole world, and it seeks to devour the male child that the woman is about to give birth. And this may be an allusion to the very beginning of the Exodus story, where Pharaoh issues a decree to destroy all male child that are born to the Israelites. The next character that appears in this narrative in chapter 12 is a male child. This male child is a minor character for now, and this male child is not the third sign. Woman giving birth is an allusion to Isaiah chapter 66, verse 7. And in the Septuagint translation, it reads, "Before she who was in labor gave birth, before the pain of her pangs came, she escaped and gave birth to a male." Which is a little different from what's found in the non-Septuagint translations. Isaiah 66 verse 7. In the English Standard Version, it reads, "Before she was in labor, she gave birth. Before her pain came upon her, she delivered a son." Now, the idea of escaping is not in the Hebrew, but it is found in the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Hebrew. This child is characterized as one who will rule all the nations with a rod of iron, which is an allusion to Psalm chapter 2, verse 9. Now, Psalm chapter 2 seems to play a pretty big role in these last few chapters here in Revelation. And Jesus delegates this task and authority of ruling the nations to the conquerors of Revelation 2, verse 27. And Jesus himself will be described in these terms in chapter 19, verse 15. So the identification of this child is pretty clear. The child is clearly Jesus. So is the birth described here the literal birth of Jesus? Now, it's frequently thought of that way. And we can certainly make that connection, and it seems to work. But the problem is the woman is not Mary. Now, there are some interpretations that try to make the woman that's described in the beginning of this chapter 12 as Mary. And if, in fact, you know, a case could be made that this woman is Mary, then this birth being the literal birth of Christ, the evidence would be there to make that connection. He'd certainly be stronger, anyway. But we see that, you know, we've already established that this woman represents the servant, the group that represents the servants of God, whether it is old Israel or the church. So it's not literal Mary, and we shouldn't try to combine literal and symbolic within a single interpretation unless that's the only logical conclusion. So if it's not literal Mary, then it's probably not, doesn't have to be a literal birth of Jesus. Mm-hmm. What's also interesting is that what appears to be Jesus' ascension immediately follows his birth. If you go all back to verse 5, she gave birth to a male child, one who is to rule all the nations with a rod of iron, but her child was caught up to God and to his throne. So there's birth, and then he's caught up. There's no intervening period. There's no description of his death. No, there's birth, and then there's being caught up, with nothing in between. Fourthly, in the book of Revelation, John shows no interest in Jesus' birth. The thing that John is interested in regards to Jesus, is his death, resurrection, and his ascension to rule, to receive the power to rule. So given that, and in chapter 5, verse 6 of Revelation, there's a reference to God and his throne. Just as in verse 5 of chapter 12 here, this child is caught up to God into his throne. The first occurrence of such phrase is in chapter 5, verse 6, where the lamb, appearing as if it was slain, appears before God in his throne. So as the background commentary we read earlier indicated, it is probably best to interpret this birth symbolically, in that this birth is actually a death in this text. Not a physical birth, but it's about what Jesus' death and resurrection accomplished. It's a birth of a new spiritual reality.
So there is the chance that the church, not necessarily giving birth, but the symbolizing that the people that always believed that God was part of the church, and then when Jesus came, the church was not necessarily giving birth, but Jesus was coming out of those believers of the church that that believed in God and their relationship with Him, and He came from that to them, and then the church was,
He came from the people in Judaism that truly worshipped God, rather than simply followed a bunch of dead traditions. And there were trials and difficulties, and out of the, that difficult time came a new spiritual reality.
This new spiritual reality is, I think, what the rest of chapter 12 is going to describe. It is the victory of Jesus over Satan.
Right.
And once we put it into that context, when we no longer see verses 7 through 12 as something that happened before the history of the earth, but rather as part of Jesus' work, all of this starts to fit better. We don't have to start pulling apart and saying this belongs to that time and that just belongs to this other time, but it begins to work out as a singular narrative.
It also goes back to that little microcosm theory I had, that the individual can be portrayed this way too, where looking at this individually as a person, it mirrors the death of your own spirituality and then giving into God's will and the rebirth of your relationship with God and your new self and life.
That makes sense.
That's my own little rabbit trail, but it's kind of interesting how almost always through these readings you can go back into your own personal
trials, giving up
your relationship with God,
birth of a new life, a new self.
Well, anything else?
So the second half is the description of the new spiritual reality.
Yeah, and what I'm saying is that an allegorical interpretation is not necessarily wrong.
Right.
But perhaps there is another alternative that fits better. Mm-hmm. We've been saying all along that Revelation is a symbolic drama, and so we would do well to prefer symbolic interpretation over a literal interpretation, particularly in sections that are confusing. We began this series of talking about Revelation by saying Revelation is not allegory. Maybe it's more of a parable than an allegory. An allegory has to assign meaning to everything. But a parable is more about the overall broad message. And so not every element in Revelation has to have a corresponding literal identification, whether it be objects, beings, time periods. It's more about the overall message than it is about the details. Chapter 12 we should see to be about the interaction between two primary characters, the woman and the dragon. And these two characters revolve around a concern of both. A male child. And rather than getting bogged down and trying to figure out the interpretation of every detail, we should be focusing on the conflict and the relationship among these characters. Now, what is their interaction? How do they relate to one another? Now, what are the actions that are taking place? So this woman is we've identified as being God's servants throughout history. The woman is not limited to the church age. The woman has existed prior to the church. The dragon we can identify as the oppressor of God's servants throughout history. Once more, it's not limited to something that arises with the rise of the church, but this oppressor has existed throughout history. The male child we have identified as Jesus. And the key event that was described in these first six verses is the birth of the male child and this male child being caught up to the throne of God. And this, we have said, it represents the death and resurrection of Jesus. Because for John, for the early Christians, for Christians throughout history, that is the defining event. And it's the defining event in history. It is what separates history from what has been to what is now. And so I believe that event, when we keep that in mind, it will help us understand what is going to be described in these next verses, as well as perhaps much of what comes in the next several chapters of Revelation.
So back to the triumph part again.
Yeah.
Yeah.